glad you're here. Georgia came to me in the back of the auditorium and said these were in the seat. So if you're missing a set of readers, 1.5 is their Jerry's.
Okay. Does he need them for class?
Oh, it wouldn't hurt.
We're glad you're here today. This week, as most of you know, Janet and I had the flu. She had a milder case than I had. She didn't think so, but it didn't seem as bad to me as mine. And it was the kind of flu that, after it was kind of all over yesterday, as we're kind of going through the recovery process, you know, I noticed a number of things. I noticed that I would run out of air going to the bathroom, walking back through the house. I noticed that my eyeballs hurt. You know, they just, it was hard to focus. We had the television on, but I found myself sitting there with my eyes closed rather than trying to look because it was just uncomfortable. And it is my custom during this time of the year around Easter, as a spiritual discipline, as a training for me, to try to take each of the days coming up to the resurrection and put myself in the position of disciples and what they must have been thinking and what it must have been like. And as I go through it, as bad as the crucifixion of Jesus is, I think Saturday must have been the worst day imaginable. Just a horrible, horrible day. And I'll talk to you about that a little bit. When I first started working on ambulance services back in the 70s, one of the first things that you're trained to do is to not get caught up in the moment, to not get tunnel vision. When you arrive at the scene of whatever accident or trauma has taken place, you need to look as wide as you can because you want to be sure you don't miss anybody and you don't want to get so focused on one thing that you miss other things going on around you. And so, while everybody else is kind of in a state of confusion, you're supposed to be calm and, you know, this isn't getting you. That, by the way, that's not true ever, but it's the way you're supposed to be. And you do learn to get better at it. And then as I started training in psychology, I learned about a concept called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is when you're hearing things, but they don't sound right. And it creates a confusion in you. And you know that it's true, but it can't be true. And so, you know, this week we recognize the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And I remember on the day that happened that I was thinking, okay, what do I need to do? How do I help? And I'm thinking, well, this can't even be right. This can't even have happened. You know, who could have done this? How did it take place? I remember the day that the Twin Towers came down. I was on the phone talking with CW for much of the morning because he was driving across Texas and couldn't even figure out what was happening. And when one tower went down, I remember looking at it thinking, well, that couldn't have happened. That can't be right. See, your brain just can't process all that information at once. And you're trying to figure out what goes on. So I'm going to invite you to turn to Mark chapter 15, and we're going to do most of our reading from that chapter, but I'm going to bring in other areas of Scripture to talk to you about. And this is after the initial betrayal in the garden. And you know, this story is one that I don't want to minimize in any way at all. But because I'm emphasizing one part of it doesn't mean the other parts are less important. It just means that I'm looking at this particular section. But in Mark chapter 15, at daybreak, the chief priests, the elders, and the legal experts, and the whole Sanhedrin formed a plan. They bound Jesus and they led him away and turned him over to Pilate. And Pilate questioned him. And Pilate said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus says, "That's what you say." And the chief priests were accusing him of many things. And Pilate asked him again, "Aren't you going to answer? What about all these accusations?" But Jesus gave no more answers. And Pilate marveled at this. During the festival, the Pilate released one prisoner to them, whoever they requested. A man named Barabbas was locked up with the rebels who had committed murder during an uprising. The crowd pushed forward, and they asked Pilate to release someone, as he rarely did. And Pilate answered and said, "Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" He knew that the chief priests had handed him over because of jealousy. But the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have them release Barabbas to him. Instead, Pilate replied and said, "Well, what do you want me to do with the one that they call the king of the Jews?" And they shouted back, "Crucify him." And Pilate said to them, "Why? What wrong has he done?" And rather than answer, they shouted back even louder, "Crucify him." Pilate, wanting to satisfy the crowd, so he released Barabbas to them. He had Jesus whipped and handed over to be crucified. Now the soldiers led Jesus away into the courtyard of the palace known as the governor's headquarters. And they called together the whole company of soldiers. And they dressed him up in a purple robe and twisted together a crown of thorns, and they put it on his head. They saluted him, said, "Hey, hail, King of the Jews." Again and again, they struck his head with a stick, and they spit on him, and they knelt before him to honor him. When they finished mocking him, they stripped him of the purple robe, and they put his own clothes back on him, and they led him out to crucify him. Simon, a man of Cyrene, Alexander and Rufus's father, was coming in from the countryside, and they forced him to carry the cross. Now, you'll note as a sideline, the reason that Alexander and Rufus are mentioned by name is that later they become Christians and followers of Jesus. So the man who carried the cross of Jesus has descendants who become his followers. They brought Jesus to a place called Golgotha, which means the skull place. And they tried to give him wine mixed with myrrh, but he didn't take it. Myrrh is a deadening agent. So he would not feel the pain as much. And he refused that. They crucified him. They divided up his clothes, drawing lots for them to determine who would take what. It was 9 in the morning when they crucified him. The notice of the formal charge against him was written, "The King of the Jews." And they crucified 2 outlaws with him, one on his right, one on his left. People walking by insulted him, shaking their heads and saying, "Ah, you who were going to destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days, were you? Save yourself and come down from that cross." And in the same way, the chief priests were making fun of him among themselves together with the legal experts. "He saved others," he said, "but himself he cannot save." "Let the Christ, the King of Israel, come down from the cross, and then we will see and believe." And even those who had been crucified with Jesus insulted him. From noon until 3 in the afternoon, the whole earth was dark. At 3, Jesus cried out with a loud shout, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you left me?" After hearing them, some of them said, "Look, he's calling for Elijah." Someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine and put it on a pole, and he offered it to Jesus to drink, saying, "Let's see if Elijah will come to take him down." But Jesus let out a loud cry, and he died. And the curtain of the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. And the centurion who stood facing Jesus saw how he died, and he said, "This man was certainly God's son." In the story of Mark, the different verses that I've put up to you all have the same question. And the question is answered by the centurion. But all of the way through the son of, or through the Gospel of Mark, the question is asked over again and over again by the people, who is this man? Who is it that the waves and the sea obey him? Who is it that the demons obey him? Who is it that even the tide pays attention to him? Who is this guy? And finally, at the end of Mark's book, it's written in such a way that finally someone answers the question. Someone who observes all that takes place and as there is a guard for it to happen, looks up at him and said, "This had to be the Son of God." Now he makes that statement while his followers are questioning that. They don't know what to do with it. See, Jesus has talked about this at least three separate occasions, that he's going to Jerusalem, he's going to suffer many things at the hands of the chief priests and elders, he'll be crucified, and he'll rise again on the third day. At least three times that we know of in Scripture, he told his disciples specifically, this is going to happen. But his disciples never really fathomed that. They never really got it. They didn't think that's the way it could be. They were convinced that there was going to be an overthrow, that somehow Jesus was going to be king, and he would sit on Herod's throne, and he would restore the kingdom to the lineage of David, and they would throw the Romans out of the country, and somehow they would be a great nation again. And they were convinced that's the way it was going to be, and they couldn't see how Jesus coming into Jerusalem could ever fit into that plan. In fact, they were so convinced of it that even the most faithful of his disciples argue with one another about who's going to sit on the right hand, who's going to sit on the left. You know, when we get into the kingdom, what's it going to be like? Which of us is going to be the head honchos? See, they didn't understand the notion of this kind of kingdom. And so when Jesus is crucified, it looks like Satan has thwarted the plan of God. It looks like somehow Satan has thrown a monkey wrench into it. And God's will isn't going to be accomplished. And the disciples who believed that they were going to be leaders in this new nation of Israel, suddenly feared for their lives. And it's no coincidence that the man who is released in Jesus' place is someone that was the leader of an uprising. And so someone that was really interested in overthrowing the physical kingdom, he gets to go free. Someone who had no interest in a physical kingdom is crucified and sacrificed. And don't think that there's no poetic symbolism in what takes place there. But the centurion looks and says, wow, this man had to be God's son. Now, if you go on after that, it's not very long. You know, the disciples we know are dispersed everywhere. They go running off because they're scared to death that they're going to be caught. And they definitely don't want to experience the same thing that Jesus did. And, you know, I've got a clue for you. You and I wouldn't have either. And so they go running away. And we have no record of their even coming together for a while. They've already begun to fabricate some new stories. Peter says, I never even knew the guy. And that's all because their brains can't comprehend what happened. There's still some people thinking clearly. A group of people go to the Romans and they say, we need to guard his tomb because this man claimed that after he was killed, he would be resurrected in 3 days. We want to make sure that doesn't happen. We need to guard the tombs. Disciples weren't thinking that. Disciples weren't sitting outside the tomb saying, let's wait for Jesus to come out. See, they weren't even considering that notion. But his enemies were. Now, his enemies, of course, thought that someone would steal the body and that they would claim a resurrection. But they were at least processing through that. Disciples don't process through that. Even the women who go to the tomb on the morning of his resurrection are not thinking that they're going to find an empty tomb. They're going to anoint the body for a permanent burial. It's done and complete. So if you've gone through this process of seeing Jesus crucified, and if you're one of his disciples standing on the outskirts, looking down from a hill or from inside a room, as you can see up on top the hill of the skull, what are you thinking? Is it all over? How can you not believe that? See, when all of the evidence comes in and overwhelms you, it's hard not to believe that that's true. And what do you suppose Saturday was like? You've had more time to think about this. You've reflected on it for a time now, and you believe that, sure enough, you know, this is true. Your brain has gone through it and said, I can't be like this, but physically, you know, he's died. Historically, in Christendom, Saturday is known as Black Saturday. And it's a day that people reflect on aimlessness, brokenness, fear, mourning, confusion. And I tried to sit down and one time, I didn't do it yesterday, but I tried to sit down one time and write down, what are all of the emotions I think I would feel? What would that look like? See, the one thing that they knew was that most assuredly the tomb was not empty. They knew that. And how are you going to believe something that has never happened? The only experience you've had with it happening is when Jesus did it, he can't do it for himself. So how are you going to believe? They had to ask a question. One of their questions most assuredly had to be, where's God now? If he wouldn't save Jesus, how in the world is he going to save you? And so the fear of being a part of the insurrection, where the leader of the insurrection has been taken and successfully killed, and you believe it's a God-inspired insurrection, suddenly you have to look around and say, if he can't save the leader, he can't save me. So I'm at risk. And you know, you and I read this from the other end of the spectrum. We know the end of the story. It is so hard to read this as though you don't know the end of the story. But let me suggest this to you. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we do. There are Christians who have a baby in the hospital and they don't know if the child's going to live or not. And they're fearful. But there's so much doubt and so much ambiguity in what's going on that they're fearful that the wrong thing could take place, and they live in Black Saturday. There are those who see their own declining health. I watched a documentary on Glenn Campbell the other day. Glenn Campbell was just put into a long-term care facility as Alzheimer's. And he did a tour with his family, and he played lots of venues, and they would have to remind him all of the time. He could still play his guitar, he could still sing songs, but they would have to remind him whether he'd already sung the song, and all the things that happens with Alzheimer's patients. And he knew where he was going. How do you live knowing where you're going to end up? That's a Black Saturday. Where's God in that? Where's God when you have COPD and you're worried about drawing your next breath? Where's God when you have a tumor on your aorta and you know at any moment you could die and you've always been healthy, but you're not now? See, that's Black Saturday still. We have all kinds of people who day after day, that's exactly where they live. I got a note from a friend of mine who has preached in Africa, not South Africa where it's nice, up into the central part, and the Christians there were being killed 3 or 4 days ago. And he wrote me asking me to pray for them. They'd come in and taken some of their children, killing some of the children, and were going to be killing other members as soon as they could find them. And that's a Black Saturday. Now we can hear that stuff and focus on that stuff and think, man, this is a miserable place to live. Here's the important thing. I don't have to pat your hand and say it's going to get better. I don't have to put my arm around you and hug you in the shoulder and say, hey, it's going to be all right. Because it may not be. Fact is, you may die of the tumor on your aorta. The fact is, your child may die in the hospital. The fact is, you may get Alzheimer's and you may linger for a long time. All of those things are possible. All of them could be your reality. But Saturday is never the end of the story. What this story tells us is that when Sunday comes, the world turns upside down. And what you've been afraid of and what has consumed your life will suddenly be nothing. And your whole world turns upside down and you look at it in a new way. But you have to believe in the power of Sunday. You have to believe in the power of the resurrection. Now, for information, Jesus didn't raise himself from the dead. The Bible tells us that God raised up Jesus from the dead. Jesus was like you and I all of the way through. He didn't have any power to change what was happening to him. He yielded before the Father and did whatever God said. He chose that. But he trusted himself to one who would be different, who would change the world. And you and I trust ourselves to exactly that same deity. So I don't know how dark it is where you live right now. I don't know whether you've been through the Black Saturday and then you had a good day and realized, hey, maybe it's not so bad. But don't allow that to deceive you. Don't think because your child leaves the hospital or because they're able to do something for your aorta or because they've misdiagnosed your Alzheimer's that means everything's all right and this world's a good place. The world isn't. It's not a good spot. This isn't all that there is. Trust eternity. And trust the God of eternity to make it different. If we can help you be what Jesus asked you to be, remember what the centurion said. Surely this man is God's son. If we can help you be that, all you need to do is come, as together we stand and sing.